which wherein Howard Braun and Selma Wise are interviewing Bob Fromerman on July 10th of at his house. Bob, say something.
It's 1997.
Okay. Bob, on tape 4, you gave us your introductory industrial experience that finally led to the point in your life when you went, you became an individual worker consultant to the industry of the area. I'd like you to pick up at that point and give us a background of how do you get a job, what do you do, essentially name the jobs and some of the things that you did for these different places, and then typically give it detail about two jobs of how you got it and what you did and how it came out.
All right. I think some of this may be a duplicate or a repeat of what went on before, but it's all right. This will probably be in a little bit better order. My last job before going into consulting, I think I talked about on the last tape, was with Newmec. And when I left Newmec in March 1962, I had no prospects, no clients, and two small children. And my problem was to be able to get things kicked off before the money ran out. And so, and I think I mentioned before that my idea originally was that the smaller companies would have a lot of need for services of my kind because they really couldn't keep people of high caliber on the payroll. They couldn't afford them in the first place and they couldn't interest them in the second place. So to use them on an ad hoc basis would seem to be an ideal situation. Well, that's what I call starting off on a false premise. It didn't work out that way. The reason it doesn't work out is because in consulting, you have no line authority, so that you can only operate by working with people who do have line authority inside the company, and that's the only way you can get things accomplished. Now, it's one thing if you're the kind of consultant that just goes in and does studies of how to or what. That was not my style. As far as I was concerned, a study was only a jumping off point for doing something material and concrete that had a real world significance. And so that was the kind of thing that I was looking to do and the kind of thing that I had done through my previous jobs. At any rate, I discovered, as I said, that small companies could not really use that kind of help. They didn't know how, they didn't have people working inside who understood what was going on. They were too thin, and so that really wasn't working. I was also calling on a number of big companies, and at that time there were a lot of big companies in Pittsburgh, and chemical engineering, at least as I was doing it, is a pretty versatile kind of art. Actually, after you've been in engineering a certain number of years, you are not a chemical engineer or a mechanical engineer or what have you, you're an engineer. And you cover a whole range of things that generally do or at least ought to go way beyond whatever you learned in your matriculation. And indeed, I was there. I found that I had all kinds of job offers. Everybody wanted to give me a job, but nobody had any consulting that they were willing to turn over. So that went on for months with only occasional very small bit things going on. And I think I mentioned before, Marcia was very patient and very understanding with all this and very believing. But eventually she came to the point where she asked, did I really think there was a market for this kind of thing? Well, I was convinced that there was. Finally, in about November or December 1962, I connected in Gervaux Corporation, and Gervaux had a contract for designing a pickle liquor, well, actually a pickling plant and a pickle liquor recovery plant to go with it. Just to straighten the record on what that means, it means dipping steel in acid to remove scale. And that's called pickling. And most pickling up to that point had been done with sulfuric acid, but this was hydrochloric acid, which is unique in that it can be recovered. And Gervaux was trying to design a recovery plant, and they had a PhD chemical engineer who kept telling them that it couldn't be done, that the absorber was impossible to design and so forth. And so when I walked in the door, they said, do it. And I didn't know that anyone inside was saying it couldn't be done, and I had never designed anything of the sort in my life, so I went away and I designed it. I not only designed it, but I predicted all its off-design performance characteristics, which it happens to be no mean trick with this kind of thing, and I won't bother you technically to say why, but it's a difficult problem. And it involved drawing an analogy from a system which was only very remotely like the system we had in hand. So, at any rate, I worked on the absorber column, and then I helped to develop the spray roaster, which is the heart of the situation, and I worked on all kinds of aspects, and the more work I did, the better we got along, and the more work came along. And in fact, my calculation book on this plant, which is a handwritten book about 3/4 of an inch thick, became the calculation Bible for Gervaux on not only that plant, but a whole series of plants that they designed and built, and for a number of others that they quoted on. And this began a long-range relationship with that company, which at that time was a medium-sized, medium to large-sized company in Pittsburgh. And it had many divisions that were doing all kinds of interesting things. And I developed a relationship where I spent 1 to 2 days a week there, at least, in their offices, and I often took home all kinds of projects to do. And I was working essentially, well, most of my work with Gervaux was with their development department, which serviced all of the divisions. And I saw maybe 90% of all the new ideas that went through that department for evaluation, and oftentimes had input to it. And as a matter of fact, I walked into the office of the head of research and development one day. His name is Mel Robinson, and I said, Mel, you know, the pollution by sulfur compounds from burning coal and boilers is becoming more and more of a problem, that is more and more of a recognized problem, and this country is going to clamp down on that, and laws are going to prohibit it and limit it, and somewhere in that is a business for Gervaux. And Mel laughed, and he said, well, last year it was the Rising Hill District, what do you think it'll be next year? In spite of which, I did a study on processes, and I came up with some 40 different processes that had been in some status.
Was that a paid study, or?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I told him that he needed
to have... So he authorized the study?
Yes. With tongue-in-cheek, he authorized the study.
Okay, that... Was Dickey there at the time?
Yes.
Did you know him, have any interaction with him?
I knew him, but I didn't have any interaction with him. I did have some interaction with John Beidler. John Beidler was a senior vice president, and he was really in charge of all the new things that Gervaux did.
You had anything.
Right, and... Okay. He was who's a charming individual and a marvelous salesperson. Uh-huh. He could sell anything.
Okay, go ahead.
So, at any rate, from that jumping off point, Gervaud began to explore various combinations, and some of them were deposits of limestone. Limestone is a principal scrubbing agent to react with sulfur dioxide and capture it. And we went through a whole series of gyrations with this, and a Hungarian chemist, Joe Salmisi, working at Gervaud, developed their, I think it was called Calcilox process, which was using a combination calcium-magnesium carbonate that had better properties for scrubbing. One of the problems with scrubbing is that you make a sludge which never ever thickens. Mm-hmm. And so you discard tons and thousands of tons a year of this soupy junk that ruins whatever landscape you dump it into. Mm-hmm. So you really want something that will set up and harden. That was Joe's contribution. At any rate, this propelled Gervaud into the lime business. And interestingly enough,
this scrubbing was this of power plant effluent?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Power plant stack gases.
Stack gases. And that's that valley out beyond Beaver or something?
Yes, yes, that's right.
That's being filled with that stuff.
That's right.
Now.
That's a Gervaud plant, and that was supposed to hold 40 years worth of sludge. And,
okay.
And once it was filled, it could then be recovered as land.
It's
set up.
Okay.
Because the material basically is pozzolanic, which means it sets up like cement. It has cement-like properties. Provided you don't throw it in as a bad, soupy mess. At any rate, that was in maybe 1963 or 64. Here we are in 1997, and the lime business is the only remnant of Gervaud that is left. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Everything else has disappeared. They've managed to dissipate everything, spoil everything else, and through bad management and one thing and another. So that, that relationship kind of underwrote me as a base client.
It was your soup bone.
And from there on, mm-hmm. other things on top of this made a very nice practice. And among the jobs that I worked on, well, you, Howard, are familiar with the Westinghouse job. This was the first job that I had consulting to Westinghouse, and it was to solve the problem of getting rid of hydrogen following a loss of coolant accident in a pressurized water reactor.
In the containment building of a...
Yes, within the containment building. And the Westinghouse solution to this problem was to catalytically recombine hydrogen with the oxygen in the air as the hydrogen was generated. And I was to evaluate this, and it didn't take very much evaluation to discover
how's it going to work.
That the chemistry of the within the containment building following a violent episode that would cause a loss of coolant accident was such that the catalyst would be poisoned and it wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, would lead to a very hazardous condition because you would have a buildup of hydrogen beyond flammable limits. And even up to detonation
levels. Well, theirs wouldn't work. Now, your solution?
Well, my solution was to burn it using hydrogen. And what I did was to conceive a burner system that operated. First of all, you have to understand that everything slams closed in the containment vessel following a loss of coolant accident. So, therefore, you can't vent. And it's very difficult to get things in. But I was going to inject hydrogen to these burners and keep a flame going and fans that would circulate the entire containment atmosphere through the burners, thereby burning the hydrogen. And the real key to the thing was the fact that this would have to be going for quite some little time, but it didn't result in the buildup of pressure in the containment vessel because the water resulting from the combination of hydrogen could be condensed.
Very small.
And so this process was patented in 6 countries, I believe, and it was used in, I really don't know how many nuclear power plants.
It had a name called?
It was a hydrogen flame recombiner. So it made a lot of people nervous because the idea of working with the hair of the dog that bit you was not overly popular, but it certainly was a solution to the problem. And the next difficulty was to put together hardware that would withstand the containment atmosphere and be operable remotely for a prolonged period of time. And that, of course, is a whole other business. And we did that.
We did that. Did you personally have a contract to supply the equipment? Or was that purchased and you supplied the engineering?
What I did was to do a design and draw the specification on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the specification was so stringent I couldn't get anyone to bid it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to a friend and a business colleague of mine who had started a company of his own in New York, Pennsylvania, Sam Lechler. And he had a company called Fabricating Engineering. He was an expert in burners, and he had his plant designed and built burners, and in addition, he had a sideline of doing control panels to contain the instruments and controls. So I went to Sam with this, and I said, Sam, if you will undertake this job, I'll make sure you come out whole. And Sam agreed, and he and I worked together on putting this thing together. And between the two of us, we designed it, and then Sam's plant supplied the hardware. And then we rented a hazardous test facility in Rocky Mount, Virginia. And we took this device out there, and we brought in a hydrogen truck, and we operated it under all kinds of conditions, demonstrate that no matter what you did with it, it was a steady, safe, old horse.
Mm-hmm.
That was an interesting project.
Mm-hmm. But you never apparently built a unit that went into a plant that you remember?
Oh, on the contrary. The first unit went into the Rochester Gas and Electric Gannett plant. And all the designs thereafter followed that design.
Mm-hmm.
Oh no, we built that unit tested.
GE and A, I believe, plant in Rochester. GE and AY. Okay.
This is a power plant.
Yes. No,
Rochester Gas
and Electric. I'm trying to name it.
The Gannett plant, GE
and
Yeah, Gannett.
Yeah.
It was named after a fellow named Gannett.
That's right.
That led to a number of other things with Westinghouse. I seem, as a matter of fact, somewhere this led to you and I meeting, and I can't quite remember when the first time was, but it goes back a few years. Then I believe I worked with one of your people whose name slips my mind at the moment, and I devised a system that was programmed into a rapid refueling program for Westinghouse.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a way of rapidly venting the reactor vessel before opening it.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, there were some very neat things in that, but I don't need to talk about all the...
Was there another job with another company you'd like to mention? You mentioned the draw. How about the one that worked down in Washington, Little Washington,
Little Washington.
Didn't you do some work for the government?
Oh, I've done a lot of work for the government.
Okay, why don't you talk about that a little?
Well, what I started to talk about before you suggested that was Pittsburgh Plate Glass.
Go ahead.
PPG were developing and beginning to sell polyurethane foams, rigid polyurethane foams. These are the kinds of foams that are used as insulation in refrigerators, in refrigerated tank trucks, and railroad cars. And they had a whole series of formulations, and I signed a contract with them to do the process design for the plant. And when I began to work on it, I discovered that all of their work had been done on teapot-sized vessels. It had been done under less than optimum conditions. And if I had attempted to scale up from their kind of data, it would have been the silliest looking plant you have ever seen in your life. Mm-hmm. So instead of doing that, I began to work with their R&D department, and I would ask for certain tests to be run, and I would ask for certain data, and I would ask for them to try out this and that, and we set up various experimental apparatus there, as a result of which I was able to design a very neat plant. This was a batch continuous plant, and it solved an enormous number of the problems that they would otherwise have had. For instance, we were able to downgrade materials of construction. There was a point in the process where various batches would go into a big tank and they would sit there for a couple of days while they were analyzed to decide what to do with them. And I suggested a system which the research department worked out that permitted an operator to go up, take a small sample, run a go-no-go test in 10 minutes, and the tank contents were shunted either in this direction or that direction, and they moved. So that we didn't have this enormous reservoir space. There were problems in separating the catalyst. At any rate, there were a whole series of problems in this thing, none of which were solved by the data that PPG had. Mm-hmm. And working with them and programming what they needed to do and the test and the data that I needed, we put it all together. And when the plant started up, and incidentally, this plant was built by the Coatings and Resins Division, who built paint plants. And so they had built a number of paint plants, obviously, but this was the first plant of this kind they had ever built. And this plant had the reputation of having the smoothest startup of any plant in their portfolio.
Do you recall any names who gave you the contract and who you worked with? I'd like a name or two with each of the companies.
Yes, there were two people there. There was Larry Streff, S-T-R-E-F-F, who is a chemical engineer, and was a very nice guy, and low-key, and he was my intimate contact on that plant.
You're direct, not your intimate.
Well, direct in that he and I actually worked out
problems
together, and Larry worked for a fellow named John Baggett, mm-hmm. John was very much impressed by all the goings on here, and he didn't really understand it, but it didn't matter because we were doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. And after the plant was, as the plant design progressed into the hardware stage, PPG brought up a Southern boy from Lake Charles, Louisiana. It's strange that his name slips my mind right now, because he and I worked together really hand in glove. He was an electrical engineer by degree, but he was an overall engineer, a very good one. And he was the project manager for PPG on the job. And PPG did not nearly have the engineering department to put this together. So between the two of us, we put out all of the specifications, and then we hired a body shop do the detailed work, detailed drafting, and all that kind of thing. And see, his first name was Jim. Jim and I moved into the body shop physically, and we split up the supervision of the job. and between the two of us, it ran through the engineering and through the procurement and so forth.
About how long did that job take?
First preliminary engineering to plant startup, a little less than a year.
That's what I wanted to hear. Yeah. And what
it was a very intense job,
yeah,
by the way.
Yes.
It was a very difficult job to bring off in that period of time.
They all are. What about that Westinghouse? Who did you contact? Wasn't it Hank von Holland?
You mean my first contact there?
Who was your principal relationship for the hydrogen recombiner?
John McAdoo.
John McAdoo.
And Blair Hagen.
And Blair Hagen. Okay, just those two names. Yeah. I'm just looking for a name or two everywhere.
And these are very good people to work with.
Yes, that is correct.
It was John, I believe, who uncovered the hydrogen problem to begin with.
Yes. And what was the job? Dravot, well, you mentioned a couple of names there. Okay.
Well, in Dravot, before I was, I consulted to Dravot for maybe 12 or 14 years.
Years, yeah.
And in that period of time, I consulted to every division of Dravot, and that included their Gibson Hill division in New York that designed power plants, and their engineering works division, and so forth.
There's a red-headed guy in New York.
Frank Hutchinson.
Hutchinson, right.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That the guy you related to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Frank came here to work for one of these waste management companies. He came here as a vice president or some such thing.
Okay. That's another company. Any more? You mentioned
I did a tremendous amount of work with the government.
Yeah, that's what I want to get to, and that'll be enough.
Yeah.
What did you do for the government? Where? Morgantown?
The first contract, Zeke Clark was in charge of coal gasification.
Clark, C-L-A-R-K.
He was in charge of coal gasification at FERDA, E-R-D-A, for Energy Research and Development Administration, in Washington.
PA?
It wasn't PA, it was Washington, D.C.
D.C.?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is headquarters. And I got a task-type contract, and the first task assigned, Morgantown, West Virginia, which had a big station, had a 30-inch fixed bed coal gasifier. And they were going to activate this thing and build onto it the necessary facilities to avoid pollution. And they were going to do this in a very jackhammer kind of way. I think they were going to scrub everything in water and burn the water. Augie Petrillo was in charge of Morgantown at that time. Augie Petrillo is quite a character. And he brought Morgantown into the station at Morgantown into great prominence because he tied in with Senator Byrd. Byrd, of course, had a great interest in keeping West Virginia and coal going. At any rate, I went down to Morgantown, and in the middle of this, by the way, Erda became I'm trying to think whether there was an intermediate before it became Department of Energy.
Doesn't matter.
But at any rate, it doesn't matter. It changed hands, but the contract kept going. And I met these people, and the job seemed to be to put some control system, a control process, on the output from the gasifier. And the reason they wanted to run the gasifier is they wanted to try and develop applications. But in order to do this, they wanted to clean the gas. I assumed that there were known processes and I would simply design a facility for them. And as I looked into it, I discovered there weren't any known processes. a matter of fact, a large engineering consulting firm before me had looked at this thing and they had sketched out their idea of a control system. And on their flow sheet, there was an arrow that ran to the bottom margin of the page, and it said to recover. So that wasn't very helpful. They didn't solve anything. So I began to put together, it took a number of processes actually between the gas, which I will not go into in detail, but each one of them was a development, and each one of them required a lot of work. But as I put together the blocks on a flow sheet and looked over what information I had available and what information I could get by running tests, I went back to Zeke in Washington and I said, you know, Zeke, it seems like a shame to overlook this opportunity. I think I can design and build a system that will clean this gas. And it's